We're going to see in chapters 29 and 30 the birthing of a nation and the shaping of its leader. And when I say the birthing of a nation, we're going to literally see the birthing of a nation as we go through this rather sordid story of how God brings about the 12 tribes of Israel. And there's some wonderful things we'll see there. Kind of some opening thoughts as we get started. These two chapters are going to span 20 years. We know that because of the 2 7-year marriage contracts that Jacob made. The first one where he thought he was going to get Rachel, and then the follow-up one when he finally did get Rachel. And then what I call kind of a 6-year service and release agreement. Although it didn't have a time frame, we know that after the birth of his 11th child, Joseph, he says it's time to go back, and Laban appeals to him for an extended period of time and some additional service. So we'll see that probably at the beginning of next week. There's a sad irony in these 20 years in that Rebekah's family, if you recall, wanted 10 days with her, right, after the wedding. And what instead they got were 20 years from her son, who she never saw again. So we see kind of some sad irony as we go through the process. And there are a lot of common threads with the prior narratives, okay? So the Bible does tend to repeat itself, similar circumstances, but we're going to see the roles reversed in almost every instance in the process. So instead of the women doing the watering, finally the men get off their rear ends and do a little work. So we see Jacob do the watering, right? And a little me Tarzan and you Jane kind of act to impress his bride. Jacob the younger supplants the older, right? His older brother Esau. While Leah, the older, is going to supplant her younger sister, Rachel. Jacob goes from self-serving to serving others in these chapters. And then, of course, the big one, the deceiver, becomes the deceived, right? And this will happen to Jacob twice over, here in this account, and then rather cruelly later, right, when he's told that his son, Joseph, had died. And when in turn he'd just been sold into slavery by his jealous brothers. So, you know, kind of the events we see between the mothers that create this scenario shouldn't be surprising to us when we see what their offspring behaves like as we continue through this journey of Genesis. Now, the wife project for Isaac was a pretty quick process, right? Servant got up there, found his gal, cut the deal, and he was out of there, right? Less than a week. So why so long for Jacob? Why do we see similar process? He went up there to get a bride. Why do you think it took so long?
God's providence.
Which is always a good answer to any question.
It's kind of the fallback answer that works every time.
And of course you were right. Yeah. But in what way do we see God's providence in this longer stay?
Yeah, certainly have to deal with David's own agenda,
okay? And I think that kind of gets to it, okay? Couple of things. He came with no dowry, right? So a little different scenario than the last time. So he had nothing to, quote, quote, buy the wife with when he showed up there. And Jacob had some serious growing up to do, which I think gets to Jack's point. And that is Laban was the instrument that God used to start to bring some growth to Jacob in his life. So he had some key life and leadership lessons that he needed to learn, and this is really what God used this time. So think of it as his wilderness time, if you will, and God shaping him. Now, what are some of the lessons that you might think come to mind? What are some of the things that Jacob needed to learn?
I have a question.
Okay, sure. Yeah, he certainly knew, right? And, you know, who else would should have known he couldn't show up empty-handed? His father, right? So his father deliberately sent him off with nothing. We'll get to that in just a second. But yeah, he knew, right? So he knew he had a different road to hoe in this kind of process. But in the process, again, in God's providence, he's learning things. So what are some of the lessons you think Jacob needed to learn based upon what we know about him?
Well, God's provision, God's timing.
Okay.
And God's handiwork in his life. I mean, he, you know, at the end you see, you know, I've served you 20 years, you know, but God's been with me. You've been against me. I mean, he learned a lot over those 20 years, but
Yeah, well, I think you hit number one and number two. Okay, so patience, which you talked about, waiting on God's timing. Right up to now, what has been their approach to making things happen? Their plan, their timing, right? So now he's going to have to learn some patience about things coming about. And then also, Doug said, this big lesson about God's providence, right? So how does he trust God's sovereignty in matters more than his own ingenuity? So, and up till now, he's just been exercising his own ingenuity in the process. God's given him these promises, and he has to learn how to trust in those promises as he goes along. Now, I also think there's probably a little bit of competence he needs to learn, right? He's been nothing other than what? A big old mama's boy for a long time, right? Doesn't mean he was without any skills, but this is his first time he's been out of the house having to fend for himself. So a little time to grow up in that process and become a man, if you will. Then I think also character, right? He has to grow in character to be the leader of the nation. So how does it feel to be deceived, right? You know, after his deceptions, both his little act on the stew with his brother and then deceiving Isaac in the process of, you know, standing in for his brother. And then yet also, I think, responding graciously, right? So, you know, look, a deception's going to happen. I mean, people are going to deceive us in our lives, and it may be people very close to us. And the question is, how do you respond, right? You can always keep this tit-for-tat thing going, right? But we see here, I think, that Jacob begins to respond graciously, and he starts to grow in character.
You know, there's a Where he's lived with his parents, he's lived up here.
Right.
You know, where he comes when he has to come under Laban, he lives way down here.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I think just in life, I looked at some guys that grew up and their dad's own businesses, and one of them said, "Oh man, that must be great. Just go to work for dad's business, and you know, some point in time, dad's going to scooch, and you're going to be the guy." And I'm actually thankful that I didn't have that kind of scenario, because even if I did, I think it's always good for any young man to get out there on his own and learn life on his own. Doesn't mean you can't come back and share in a father's business or something, but clearly we see some growth in character resulting from the process. So he had some lessons that he had to learn. So how does the text break down? Well, kind of two providential things in the first 12 verses. The first is the providential arrival, right? Jacob seems to somehow magically happen upon the well, where they're all hanging out. Well, of course, God's providence in that. And then we see this providential encounter with whom he hopes is going to become his wife. Followed by good old Uncle Laban, right? This guy is a character, isn't he? There's always, everybody's got an Uncle Laban, right? And little chuckles, everybody's got an Uncle Laban somewhere. You know, he's just kind of a mixed cat, but we then encounter him again in verses 13 and 14. Then we see this marriage contract in fulfillment in verses 15 to 20, followed by the deception and the aftermath of the deception in verses 21 to 30. Now, the centerpiece of this section is this long recounting of the birth of the royal family. So this is kind of the centerpiece of the whole Jacob narrative, okay? And it is kind of the point of the chapter. And then finally, we're going to see God's prospering of Jacob in the final verses of chapter 30, 25 to 43. So it's interesting, as we watch this journey, we watch God kind of sequentially fulfilling the promises, right? You know, I'll be with you, you'll have many descendants, okay? Boom, gets that, we see the descendant part. Right after we see the descendant part, what do we see? The blessings or the prospering, God, how God works through the circumstances to begin to prosper Jacob before he returns to the land. And then in verse 30, chapter 31 and beyond, we're going to see what? What was God's final promise? I will bring you back. Okay, so we kind of see these chapters basically giving us the narrative detail of the promises that God made to Jacob back in chapter 28. So the theme really here of the section, I think, is the formation of the nation and the shaping of its patriarchal leader. Okay, so we're going to see the actual physical formation of the nation in the 12, what will become the 12 tribes, and the shaping of its patriarchal leader, fulfilling God's promises to Jacob. Again, okay, so we see everything. God makes promises, God fulfills them, and we're seeing kind of the narrative account and story for that. So, someone read the first six verses of chapter 29 for me. We'll get started.
He looked and saw a well and a field and cold across the street were lying there beside him. For from that well they watered the flock. Now the stone on the mouth of the well has what was lodged. When all the flocks were gathered there, they would then roll the stone in the mouth of the well and water the sheep, and put the stone back in its place on the mouth of the well. Jacob said to them, "My brothers, where are you from?" They said, "We are from Haran." He said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know him." And he said to them, "Is it well with him?" And he said, "It is well." And he was preached of his daughter coming with the sheep.
Okay, so we have this providential arrival now, right? So the vision and vow over, Jacob sets out for Haran. Little Hebrew's kind of funny. It says he's kind of high-stepping his way out of there. So he's moving. He's getting on the way to go. So the event's over. He literally lifts up his feet, high-stepping his way out, and the account fast-forwards to his arrival. Okay? So we get, in one verse, he left, and he got there. That's 400 miles. Now, I don't think he went on a magic carpet or anything, but the point is simply to tell us that the journey wasn't eventful or not important in terms of what God wants us to know. Where he happens upon a well with some shepherds with three flocks sitting around it. Okay? Now, recognizing from our perspective, of course, God's providence in this, right? So God has guided him precisely to where he needs to be to begin the process of the wife. Now, verses 2 and 3 set the scene for what follows, right? So he sees this well. He sees three flocks of sheep kind of just pasturing there. He sees the shepherds associated with those sheep sitting around at what would appear to be a somewhat odd time of day for doing that. And we start to then get some context for what comes next. Now, verses 4 to 6 serve as a confirmation that he has arrived at the intended destination. And we have what sounds like the world over a typical guy conversation, right? This is a guy conversation. It's perfect. It's exactly how we talk, right? Where are you from? Haran. Okay. Do you know Laban? Uh-huh. Yeah, we know him. Is he well? Yep. Perfect, right, guys?
Yeah.
I mean,
is that right there?
Yeah, I mean, we got everything across we need to get across. You know, how well is he? How's the kids? You know, you ladies will come back and fill in the details for us afterwards. But the fact is, we have this kind of typical. Now, I tease about it being a guy conversation. They don't know who this guy is, right? So they're going to be somewhat guarded, naturally, in the kind of responses. So they're politely responding, kind of giving out the minimum amount of information. But then I guess they had a fit of loquaciousness, right, at the end of that, because they add this little thing in the end. And look, here comes his daughter, Rachel. Okay, well, that's interesting, setting up the providential encounter. Now, I don't know if commentators just get tired or they got to have a certain amount of pages to be a commentary or something. There's more talk about, well, notice how he noticed the sheep and this, and then he noticed it, and he looked at Rachel and he noticed the sheep. I'm like, what else are you going to see? There's just sheep and girls out there. I mean, I don't know why they make such a big deal about it. But the fact is that he observes, and here she is, okay? And so we're going to begin to have this encounter. So let's read verses 7 to 12.
And he said, "Lo, it is yet high day, neither is it time that the cattle should be gathered together. Water you the sheep and go and feed them." And they said, "We cannot until all the flocks be gathered together, until they roll the stone from the well's mouth. Then we water the sheep." And while he yet spake with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she kept them. And it came to pass, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled a stone from the well's mouth, and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. And Jacob kissed Rachel, and lifted up his voice, and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's brother, and that he was Rebekah's son. And she ran and told her father.
Okay, so we've had the arrival now, so now we have, not surprising, this providential encounter, right? So it's been confirmed, and we turn to the encounter that he has with Laban's daughter, Rachel. Now, what is the point of verse 7? What is the point? Why does Jacob, urge these guys to get out and get to work? What's that?
He wants some alone time.
There you go. The women always get these questions, right? He wants to be alone with Rachel, right? Because who wants the kid brothers hanging around during the courtship, right? So he wants these guys out of there. He wants her all to herself. It is kind of odd, all right? But they what? They demur, citing their everyday practice of waiting to remove the stones. Though surely they're curious about what's going to come next. So it probably gives us some clues. These were probably younger kids. All right, this is probably a pretty big stone. They probably literally did have to get everybody together because they all had to move the stone together and move the stone back. So there's reality and truth to the story, but there's also a little bit of humor in the process, I think, here as well. Now, verse 9 tells us that Rachel is a shepherdess, okay? So we know she's a pretty hardy gal, okay? A shepherdess out there by herself. Now, what's notable about verse 10? What's notable about verse 10? What kind of jumps out at you when you read it? What gets reinforced? Yeah, Jack.
Well, he noticed Rachel, but he also noticed the sheep.
Yeah, noticed Rachel, he noticed the sheep. So he's saying, okay, she got some. Yeah?
Mother's brother?
My mother's brother, three times. He's like, okay, I got it after the first two. Mm-hmm. My mother's brother, my mother's brother, my mother's brother. Okay, so really, they're confirming, right, or emphasizing the importance of this family connection. So the pact is, he said, what? Go to Haran, find somebody from my people, keep the line pure, and they're emphasizing, yep, he's there, he's there, he's there. We want to make sure we go through that. Now, there's something else that's interesting about verse 10. What's that? Something else interesting about it.
He moves the stone.
Yeah. Yeah. So, the role reversal, right? So, Jacob does the watering, right? So, he doesn't test Rachel's mettle. Rather, he seeks to prove his own mettle through an act of strength, right? You ladies were all impressed with our strength, right, when we were younger. We've all just faded just a little bit in our older age here. But, you know, we were all young Tarzans right back then, right? So he gives her one of these poses. Now I get that rock for you. Come on. All right. So he gets in, he jumps in, and he takes the rock away, right? And he goes through the process. Now, how does this providential encounter end? How does it end? What happens at the end? In verse 11 there. Yeah, that's one thing. That's exactly true. He does. Okay, what happens before that?
He kissed her,
right? Lift up his voice and wept. Now, that's a little odd, right? He gives her this familial kiss, right? He knows she's family. But the fact is, she doesn't know he's family at this point in time. So she's probably a little surprised and maybe a little fearful in the process right here. So while a customary practice, it seems like Jacob's emotions have gotten away with him and his delight that he's found the right place, so he reverses the order. You know, he gives her a big smacker first, and then he says, oh, by the way, I'm your relative. She must have been, whew, okay. All right. So the process is just kind of funny. It's a little bit of humor, again, in the process as we go through it. Now, and like her aunt before her, as Danae said, what does she do? Well, she scurries home to tell Laban. This is a big deal, right? Remember, life there was probably pretty dull. What did you do every day? Come on, you sheep, let's go. It's time to get to the water, sitting around, watching them eat, right? And now all of a sudden you got this hardy young guy showing up. Now, a little different than the servant, right? Because the servant, he had some what? We had a good word for it back then. Bling. He had some bling, right? Jacob don't got no bling. Okay, he's got pecs, I guess. No bling, just pectorals. Okay. None other than good old Uncle Laban, right? So she goes back, and here we got good old Uncle Laban. So let me read verses 13 and 14.
And it came to pass, when Laban heard the report about Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. So he told Laban all these things, and Laban said to him, surely you are my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him for a month.
Okay, so why is good old Uncle Laban significant? Why is he significant in the story? What's his purpose in all this?
He's
kind of talked about it before.
He remembers. He knows who Jacob is.
Yeah, he remembers who he is. But he's going to be the inauguration of the schooling of Jacob, right? Yep. Okay, so God's going to providentially use this guy. Now, they start off on a good foot, right? He gets the old family hug and a kiss, right? And here he goes in the process. I remember the first time I met my in-laws in China. I said to Katie, I said, well, what should I expect? What are the customs when you're meeting somebody? Of course, I can't speak any Chinese, so one of these kind of things. And she said, well, they're not really affectionate people, per se. And said, well, what will happen if I give your mom a hug? And she says, she's probably just going to stand there like this. Well, sure enough, I came in, I gave her mom a hug, and she stood there. Like that. So I took one arm and put it around my back and took her other arm, rested in. She got a big smile on her face. And here's her dad. He's looking for his hug, too. So it was kind of a funny experience. Different cultures, different scenarios. But so you see, you can communicate a lot without words. But here we go. Okay, he's going to start the schooling of Jacob. And from here through the end of chapter 30, he's going to get a rapid fire education, right? He's going to get subjected to a whole bunch of stuff that's going to make him grow up fast. Now, surely remembering his last encounter with Abraham's line, he certainly hustles out to greet him. And I don't want to totally throw Laban under the bus here. I think he demonstrates a reasonable amount of affection, genuine familial affection. But I'm sure that little devil in the back of his head's going, a lot of bling last time, a lot of bling, right? So he hadn't forgotten all the goodies that he got last time they came. But surely he was probably a little conflicted, right? When he looked at Jacob. Now, the text continues saying that Jacob related to Laban all these things. Okay, so what is it that you think Jacob shared with Laban? It says all these things, okay? So it's pretty specific, all these things. He related all these things.
Probably what his mission was. I mean, that he was there to get a wife.
The whole story. You know,
okay, so wife, what did you say, Larry?
His whole story from his mother all the way through.
Yeah, okay, right. Other thoughts?
Same thing.
Yeah, same thing. Okay. Yeah, so at a minimum, certainly he would have been expected to explain his coming, right? I mean, you just don't show up. There had to be a reason for that. So the wife's search certainly would have sufficed, I think. But I do personally think that even though I can't be dogmatic, I lean towards a fuller disclosure of the events of chapter 27. Okay, so I think he probably really explained everything that happened, right? Kind of in a genuine honesty in the process. Now, I can only kind of piece this together, right? I can't put any kind of direct evidence, but there are some things that might lead us to the conclusion. So what are a couple reasons why you might lean towards a full disclosure?
Laban's response.
Which is what?
Well, the taking care of, teaching, mentoring.
Yeah, I'm not sure he taught and mentored. He kind of whipped and pushed him in the corner. But, yeah, he did take him in, so no doubt about that.
He taught him the consequences of sin.
Yeah, that's true. He did. No question about that. Okay.
Well, he showed up empty-handed, so.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's the big idea. Logically, it had to be more than what she told him, right? He could have figured all that out, and he could have divined the general idea of the wedding. I mean, come on. The last time a kid needed to get married, he showed up, so back to the bride pool again. But I think it's really this thing that suggests full disclosure is his condition, right? I mean, it would have been very obvious to him that Jacob had nothing. I mean, there was a big word, I can't even remember it, in one of the commentaries, I had to look it up, which means broke. He showed up broke. I mean, he had nothing, okay? So clearly, I think he had to explain, because Laban would have wondered, right? I mean, customary or not, whether the old man's loaded or not, if you were coming for a bride, you'd have been bringing some dowry with you in the process, okay? And he shows up with absolutely nothing. So Laban probably wondered, are you a fugitive? What are you doing? Are you running away from the law? Whatever. So I think a full disclosure really is in order here. And I expect he told him the whole story. Okay, hey, I did this, we did this, we kind of tricked the old man on the birthright thing and all that kind of stuff. So I think he explained the whole process in that. Now, what about his condition would have been needed explaining? We've done this 100 times already. He arrived empty-handed. And unlike the servant, right, he didn't seem to be in any rush, right? So he stayed with him for a month, and Laban took him in like a family member for that period of time. Now, why do you think Isaac sent him away with nothing? we're all in the speculation phase here, so you can.
He had the blind insight.
I think he was mad at me.
Don't grow up.
Give it to the older son.
What, gave it to the older son?
Yeah.
Ah.
He gave the blessing.
Yeah.
But he sent him away with nothing. Why wouldn't he send him with everything?
Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that possibility. He does come back. They never really say he comes back to claim anything other than the rightful position. So
he gets away from Laban.
Yeah.
He was deceived.
Yeah, yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't thought about that. That's possible. I think Roger's got a possible point. I can't say for sure, but to describe, I think, some displeasure, right? Okay, kid, you tricked me. You're on your own. You get out there and so forth. So Laban subsequently accepts Jacob as family, right? My bone and my flesh, and he stays with him as a guest for a month, right? Now, we lead to 15 to 20. Somebody read those for me. Okay, so what do you make of Laban's question in verse 15? What do you make of that question?
Oh, he's putting the bait out there. Why
didn't he? I like that when you said that. Look, first off, remember this question. We're going to see it again. What shall be your wages? Okay, so it's a trick question. I think, first of all. But secondly, it's a mixed bag, right? With a nod towards self-interest, all right? So I said to you many times that Eastern communication is very high context, okay? There's a lot of high context in here that he would have been able to interpret. So on the one hand, I think Laban's saying, look, you ain't going to mooch off me. You may be family, but if you're going to stay here, you're going to work, right? And, obviously he had been working, I expect. I suspect he was pitching in, doing the chores. But he made it clear, hey, you're not here as family, okay? Nothing's been transacted at this point in time. So if you're going to stay, basically Laban says, well, we'll get to that in a second. Or, on the other hand, Jacob had obviously been pitching in. He's seen his facility with the flock, so he wants to secure his services, okay? So Laban obviously observes that Jacob is a talented guy, right? I'm sure he had jumped in, he'd helped out, he'd done various different things, so he wants to secure his services. Now, how does Jacob respond to the question? How does Jacob respond to the question? Okay, so you said he put out the bait. Does he take the bait?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think he does, actually.
He makes his preference known.
Yeah, he does not take the bait. He does not accept a pay-for-hire deal. Okay? So notice what he did. He put out the bait. Let me hire you as my servant. Basically, he just wanted to hire him as a hired hand. He wanted there to be a clear upper hand scenario, no family thing whatsoever, and Jacob doesn't take the bait. Now remember, this is going to come up again when we get to the end of chapter 30, when he's doing his work and release agreement. And he says to him there, what shall my wages be? Okay, so Jacob is very careful not to get himself indebted to him with no gain coming out the back end, right? Laban, he'll hire him forever. And Jacob will never come out of that deal with a positive level. Okay, so instead what he does is he proposes a marriage contract. All right, that's his solution to Laban's offer. He comes back with a marriage contract. He says he'll work 7 years for the hand of Laban's younger daughter, Rachel, which is a little odd at first, okay, and which is an excessively fair offer, Okay, so he doesn't want the offer to be turned down by any means. So we do see that Jacob has some patience in him and a willingness to wait. So what do you say about Jacob's choice of Rachel? What do we say about that?
Well, that's contradictory to the hierarchy of the family model.
Sure, certainly contradictory, okay. But what does he base his choice on?
The appearance.
She's a looker. She's a looker. Oh, yeah, I'll take that one, right? So, like Laban's question, I'd say it's mixed. Okay, he's kind of a mixed response. On the one hand, it's superficial, based on external beauty, but also, more importantly, who's left out entirely? Yeah, God, well, Leah is. No, not really. No, God's left entirely out of this thing, right? I mean, he doesn't even throw a bone towards God, right? He doesn't even come through with, like Mark said, I'll come up with the fancy words and it'll just bless it all, right? No, he doesn't do anything. He just continues to move forward in his own strength, relying solely on himself. On the other hand, it does seem to embody a genuine love. I mean, he does seem to have a genuine love and affection. Maybe he's just smitten with her, but he does, for her. And he already knows that she's a capable shepherdess, right? So he knows she's a worker. He doesn't really have to test any of those things. But he does really base it kind of on fairly superficial kind of characteristics in the process. So I guess we could apply that same verse I used this morning. The grass withers and the flower fades, which says, when none of us is getting prettier while we're getting older, okay? But the Word of God gets more beautiful as we get older, right? So we take on a different form of beauty as we age in the process, but not necessarily she focuses on that. So whatever the true motive, Jacob does seem to have been infatuated with her from the start, right? I mean, he's just smitten with Rachel.
Can we back up just a second here? I'm a little confused.
Yeah.
All right, so when we go back to chapter 28,
right?
Isaac's telling him, go there, go see Laban, get yourself a wife.
Yep.
So that's no mystery,
Nope, no mystery at all.
So there's, and so Laban, is he in this loop too?
Laban would have understood.
That's his purpose?
Yeah, he would have understood that. So when I say, what was the disclosure? For Jacob to disclose, I'm here to get a wife, is like the patently obvious. Okay, Laban would have known that just based upon what you're referencing. I'd just been through this whole thing. Same family, same process, eligible young bachelor. Laban gets it, what he's there for. Okay, so when I said from a fuller disclosure, I think that's what gives us, you know, reason to believe that Jacob told him the whole sordid story about the trickery that he did back there.
Right.
Okay,
so probably would have told him also that that's what he's there for.
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, he would have certainly said, yeah, that's, I'm here for a wife as well, and so forth and so on. Okay, so Laban's not confused. But Laban, when I say Laban's got kind of a mixed reaction of both, you know, I think some genuine affection and certainly greed, he's probably leaning more towards, okay, what am I going to get out of this deal? Guy showed up with nothing, all right? How does he expect to get a wife from me if he showed up with nothing? Okay, so that's kind of the process.
This sort of makes it a formality, you know, that now we have a contract,
mm-hmm.
We have boundaries, and, you know, Laban was probably thinking, well, how long is this guy gonna hang out here before he shows his hand complete, before he indicates who he's interested in?
And that's why Laban does the question.
Right.
I mean, he kind of customarily lets him stay for a month.
So he kind of knew what he was there for,
right.
But you need to have the boundaries. You know?
Yeah, and he let Jacob hang out for a month before he said, okay, dude, look, you've been here a month. Yeah. What's the deal?
See, I think that's pretty important there, editorial-wise, for a month.
Yeah.
Family or not, you don't want somebody coming and staying with you for a month.
We're getting a little insight into the family dynamics here, buddy. I tend to agree with him on that.
If they cut the grass, watch the car.
Yeah, right. If they're a good cook and they buy the groceries and cut the grass, I might let them stay for a while. But yeah, you're right.
It was customary back then, though, wasn't it? More customary for folks to stay for an extended period of time.
Yeah, hospitality. Eastern areas of hospitality goes beyond our Western mindsets. We think if somebody's there for a week, we're doing them a favor, right? And Western would have been longer. But yet, you do see, right, when you put all that together, you see the fact that he's saying, hey, look, you know, it's been a month. We ain't going to continue with this deal indefinitely. Okay, so what shall I pay you? Now, so it looks like he's being magnanimous, right? Oh, should you serve me for nothing? Yeah, Roger.
Remember last time, the family sent a servant.
Right.
To get to Laban.
Right.
He wasn't there that long.
Right.
So why wouldn't they have sent a servant to get him his wife?
Right.
Why send him?
Yeah. So another reason for why he would have had to do full disclosure.
Some don't.
Yeah, enough is different about this situation, right? So the whole pattern was different. Before, they didn't want to risk them leaving the land, sends a servant to do the work, comes with the dowry. It's pretty clear what's happening there. Does his deal, cuts the deal, leaves, right? Now we have a whole different scenario. Same family, different picture. No servant, no camels, no this, no that, right? So we see a different picture. So yeah, I mean, Laban would have understood that. Yes.
Could Laban also have just been keeping some options open for himself? I mean, he always got the guy showing up with nothing.
Right.
And say, well, you're going to work, but maybe he was thinking Jacob might have said, well, I'll work for X number of dollars an hour.
Right.
And he, and maybe some other guy shows up with a bunch of
things right.
with gold and silver and all
yeah.
that.
Yeah. Yeah, clearly, again, you guys are starting to get the idea of high-context communications, okay? There was a subtext to the question, which is, where's the good stuff, right? Now, he didn't really know how the good stuff was going to get there. So in the meantime, he could have been waiting for another servant to show up. Well, maybe they sent him out as an advanced guy. Maybe they want to change up the order this time. Yeah, Bobby?
Or if he said he would work for X amount of wages, he'd get the wages back because then he'd have to buy...
Use that money to buy? Well, that would be interesting, too. Yeah, I think so. I think the big thing, I think Jacob recognizes, I'm not going to put myself in a pay-for-hire situation. Yeah, Laban could have figured, yeah, I'll pay the guy and as soon as he gets enough. But then Jacob realizes, the guy's sneaky. How am I ever going to know what enough's going to be? You know, I may be working 40 years before he decides, you know, and there'll always be another reason. As we get later in this story and he leaves... You know, you'll recall when Laban confronts him later, what does Jacob say? He's going to say, look, you've changed the deal on me 10 times, right? So obviously Laban hasn't been straightforward. So yeah, you do get the general idea here, which is there's a big subtext going on here. He shows up, he's clearly there for a wife, circumstances are different, and Laban's wanting to kind of draw it to a conclusion and see what's going on, and he's not going to go indefinitely waiting for Jacob to play his hand. Because Jacob is obviously, you know, not, I mean, he's told him the whole scoop, but he doesn't seem to be in any hurry, right? Contrary to the other ones. Okay. Did I answer your question?
You did.
Okay.
Now, are we going to talk about the 7 years thing?
Are we going to talk about it?
Yeah.
Yeah, we're getting there.
Okay.
No question about it? Okay. In my normal pattern of inchworming along.
The chapter took 20 years to get out. Yeah.
Thank you, Larry. That's pretty good. Okay, so Laban offers this kind of apparently cool response, right? At one time in my career, I did commercial real estate for a while, and it was in the Washington, D.C. area, and it was dominated by Jewish guys. And, you know, it's the first time in my little whitey life I've ever been a minority in any shape or form. And it was just hilarious in a lot of these conversations. And I just read these, they're going, oh, yeah, come on, it's okay, you know? And so this cool response, why should I give her to anybody else? Of course, you take her. Right? And then he kind of throws in at the end, I'll take the deal. Right? Okay, so he's trying to, again, act magnanimous in this whole process. But again, he's just going through the process. Now, nothing more about the next 7 years is reported, what? Than the fact that they passed quickly because of his love for her. Now, I think that is all I had to say. What's your question about 7 years?
Why did he say 7 years? Wasn't he 70 years old and again?
Yeah. Showing a lot of patience. They're 70, ain't our 70, brother.
I guess.
He is about 70 at this point. He is.
You think?
Yeah.
How do you get there?
I have to go back and look at the notes, but he is. It's been a while. As you read most of the commentaries, they'll tell you he was upwards of 70 years old. So.
Why is he just getting a wife at that age? That makes no sense.
Why was he a mom?
I could say good sense. Well, that would cause a problem, wouldn't it? No, look, I mean,
he's been
a mama's boy. Yeah, but these are good questions to ask of the text. I mean, we don't want to get caught up in them. Doug, I'll bring you some information to show you that, where they get at that. You can check it out. But he's pretty far along. Like, he's 70. He's in no rush, okay? But why 70 years? It doesn't say. I mean, you know, there's a whole group of people around that do stuff around numerology of the Bible, what different numbers in the Bible mean. Seven is generally held to be the number of completion. So it could be that, hey, that's a full and complete serving for this. I would say that customarily they wouldn't have offered a term anywhere near this length. So if anything, it's just let me be excessive to make sure that you don't turn the deal down.
Do you think that maybe in the he was hoping that in those 7 years Leah would get married? I mean, if there was, is there a tradition there that the older daughter must marry first?
No, he wouldn't have had any concept. I mean, this trickery is beyond comprehension. We'll get to that.
Well, not that he anticipated a trickery.
Right.
But if is there a tradition that the older daughter must marry first?
Well, he says there was later.
So maybe he thought, if I wait 7 years, hopefully Leah will be married, and then it'll be legitimate that Rachel can be married.
I think we're probably getting too Eastern at this point in time in terms of trying to read in subtext there. But no, I don't think so. I mean, I think the simple reading that I would be is that 7 years would be considered by anybody an excessive offer, and he wants to just ensure that he accepts the offer. Okay? He realizes he doesn't have much bargaining power. Hey, Jack?
His eyes were weak. Is she supposed to be put out here as kind of like damaged goods?
Yeah, I mean, she's Leah literally means wild cow. I mean, in the Hebrew. I don't know. I mean, yeah. What the commentaries say, and I don't know if it's right or wrong, is the idea that her eyes were bright. I mean, you've seen somebody with bright, sparkling eyes, and it might have been a feature that they prized. But, you know, it says form and appearance here. So, you know, look, she wasn't the more attractive of the two sisters externally, I think is what I would conclude from that. Now, how unattractive she was, that's pure speculation. You know, I don't think she was crawling around on all fours, you know, eating that with the pigs or anything. But the fact is that her eyes were not radiant, okay? And so she didn't have the same spark, I guess, as Rachel did, okay? So I wouldn't say anything more than that. That all I can figure on that. Well, that's good. I got more questions on that than I ever figured I'd get as we go through the process.
I need another cup of coffee.
Go ahead, Larry. We may take 20 years at this pace. But yeah, look, it is interesting. So my conclusion is simply 7 years, an offer that really couldn't have been refused, which is why he's focused in on that. And he wants to make sure that he agrees to the transaction. Okay, so nothing more is said about it other than they pass in the blink of an eye. He serves wonderfully and faithfully. And the stage is now set for the treachery that follows. So somebody read 21 to 30, please.
And Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my time is completed, that I may go into her." And Laban gathered all the men of the place and made a feast. Now it came about in the evening that he took his daughter Leah and brought her to him, and Jacob went into her. Laban also gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came about in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served with you? Why then have you deceived me?" But Laban said, "It is not the practice in the place to marry off the younger before the firstborn. Complete the week of this one, and we will give you the other also for the service which you shall serve with me for another 7 years." And Jacob did so and completed her week and gave him his daughter Rachel as his wife. Laban also gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as her maid. So Jacob went into Rachel also. Indeed, he loved Rachel more than Leah, and he served with Laban for another 7 years.
Okay, so there's just a ton packed into this whole scenario, right? So what's odd and telling about verse 21 just from the start here? What's a little funny about that?
Jacob is the initiator.
Who said that? What'd you say?
That he had to pass.
Yeah, why do you have to remind him?
Yes.
In 7 years is 7 years. That's pretty objective, right? So he's got to start off by reminding good old Uncle Laban, right? He has to pursue payment. He has to remind Laban he's fulfilled his side of the deal. Now give me my wife. Okay? So he's ready, obviously. I'm sure Laban had not forgotten. He was just dragging his feet. So we just see Laban's character over and over again. But he does kick into action, right? He prepares the marriage feast, right? And they typically could have gone on for a week. We don't know how long it went on here, but it would have been a very merry time. He brings everybody together. They're feasting on lamb or whatever they're eating. They're drinking a lot of wine. It's a very festive kind of occasion and potentially spanning about a week. After which, the bride is brought to the marital tent, and the marriage is then consummated. Okay, so this was the process of a wedding in the ancient Near East. Now, does the fact that Jacob doesn't recognize the switch seem far-fetched to you guys?
Yeah, well, in Eastern society today, or the Western society today, yeah.
Okay, I love Larry. He's on today. Yeah, to our Western minds, absolutely. Right? Sounds weird to us, okay? But just want to get me to remember a couple things. They're in the desert. Anybody ever really been in a dark, dark place at night?
Yes.
You can't see your own hand, number one, okay? So, number one, it was dark. Number two, she would have been veiled when she came in, okay? Number three, they probably, you know, did a little trickery, just like Jacob did, right? Maybe they threw on some of Leah's or Rachel's clothes. Maybe they gave her some of Rachel's perfume. Okay, maybe they said no chit chat. I mean, you know, this was a very premeditated thing. Okay, so there's no reason to believe that they weren't as deliberate in their deception as Jacob was in his perception, right? And Jacob had been partying. Okay, so I'm sure he was happy. I'm sure he was a little festive. Now, whether he had a few too many wines at the wine bar before he went in there or not, we don't know. But look, there's a lot of reasons to believe that this could happen, okay? It's not quite as far-fetched as it would seem to our Western mind. But, yeah, Bobby.
No more far-fetched than him tricking the father into thinking he was the other son who was Harry.
Yeah, exactly right. Okay, so you looked at the deception they did there. Exactly right. Yeah, well, I've got that in here later. It seems to run in the family, right? Trickery seems to run in the family DNA. But yeah, so look, it does seem kind of strange to our Western mind, but we got to remember that the conditions were quite a bit different back then, and, you know, it could see. And, you know, in the Hebrew, it's a little more emphatic, and he says, when he woke up in the morning, behold, it was Leah! Whoa! Okay, so he was surprised, okay? So I think he genuinely didn't know. Okay, so it is not inconceivable. What is more inconceivable than Jacob being fooled? Now, the depth of the deception. I mean, Laban was devious, but this is really beyond any reasonable comprehension, right? This is nasty, okay? Yeah, after 7 years, right? Forget the 7 years, for 7 minutes, I mean, whatever, it's still kind of nasty in the whole scenario, okay? And further, it required the consent of both Leah and Rachel, right? Leah and Rachel had to be in on this deal. Now, why do you think they conceded to this plan?
So their dad could get another 7 years out.
Yeah. You think they cared about it? Yeah? No. But look, the answer is simple. They didn't have any rights. I mean, they were just like cattle. Okay? And they, I guess I shouldn't say that with her name being Wild Cow. But the fact is, they were just possessions. Okay? Women didn't really have any rights in that society. And what do you think motivates Laban to do this? What motivates him to do it?
Greed, keep him around.
Well, okay, now you can have your question. Really, now we really see the unbridled greed, right? I mean, we see the true character of Laban once we get that. So despite his convenient excuse, right, wouldn't it seem that you would have brought that up back at the contract time, mm-hmm. right? So he kind of left that out. So whether that's true or not true, maybe close enough to true in their culture, but the fact is he kind of left that thing. Seems like he would have explained this custom back in verse 18. So what else might we note about Laban's character in all this? He's just completely self-absorbed, right? Yeah, just completely self-absorbed. He places his daughters in a really untenable situation, even considering their lowly rights, right? I mean, it's really nasty. I mean, it isn't just what he does to Jacob. Think what he does to his two daughters in this situation. You think that's going to work out very well? I don't think so. And of course, we're going to see that in the next section, right? But, you know, it's just, it's cruel. So we see cruelty. You see just incredibly self-absorbed behavior. Yeah, Roger.
After he's told Laban about everything that has happened.
Right.
Do you think this is kind of like a stick in the back?
Yeah. Paybacks, maybe? Now, I don't think Laban's doing anything to protect his sister, per se.
No.
But yeah, he said, hey, he pulled it on his old man.
I can do it.
I can pull it on him, right? I mean, that was his father. That's a far more important relationship. This is just a couple of wives, right? So the fact of the matter is, yeah. I mean, the so you do see, you know, Jacob's kind of an interesting character, right? I mean, on the one hand, he's a smart guy. There's no question about that. You see how he's done things. But he's pretty naive, isn't he? I mean, he's pretty honest in the process. He lays himself out completely to Laban. And Laban's just like, oh, man, this guy's toast. I got him, right? So, yeah, I think it is. And not payback in that it was hurting Laban in any way. Yeah.
He could have told Laban that, you know, he was the younger son. He didn't have anything.
Right.
And I want a wife.
Yeah.
I'm coming to you to get a wife.
Sure. He could have been dishonest.
Yeah.
But he wasn't. Right? Yeah. So we see the character developing in Jacob as we go through the process. All right? All right. So morning sheds light. What's surprising about Jacob's response now? What's surprising about his response?
I would have just been like, no, I gave you 7 years. I want the right wife. And today he's offering more.
Yeah, exactly right. He doesn't put up much of a fight. No. She's absolutely right. He doesn't put up much of a fight, right? What have you done to me? Okay. Right? I mean, he doesn't put up a fight, right? Why not?
Well, once he's consummated the marriage,
right?
Isn't he really doing the responsible thing?
Yeah.
To honor that relationship now.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Absolutely, that's one thing.
He's getting what he wants in the end.
Right. But you know, all right. Now, well, how did I? Yeah.
If he puts up a stink, then he may lose the chance to actually get Rachel.
Yeah. How did Isaac respond when he discovered the treachery? He didn't put up a big fight, did he?
No, he didn't. He was pretty calm.
What did he do? He kind of wailed about it. Mm-hmm. What did he recognize? What's that?
God's in control.
God's in control. Okay, he's kind of like Isaac's response back in 27:33. Okay, so Isaac had, remember, this kind of emotional outburst, but he ends that one verse and says, and yes, he will get the blessing. Okay, so I think Jacob has a similar kind of experience here. He recognizes God's providence in the situation. Okay, he recognizes God's providence. He doesn't put up a big stink. So like his father, he notes God's sovereignty in the matter, and he quickly accepts it. Though, he does challenge the duplicity. Okay, it's not like he completely lets Laban off the hook. He does challenge it, right, before acquiescing to the solution. He does fulfill Leah's week and give him another 7 years. So I think we might see, to Betty's comment here, a note of hint of maturation in Jacob. Okay, he clearly could have objected. Okay, in ancient Near East culture, he could have absolutely said, no way, this was the one, okay, you give me that one. And he would have been completely within his rights to do that. But he does seem to have, as you note, some sense of responsibility of Leah's feelings, taking that into account. She would be completely unmarriable if he'd pushed her back at this point in time, right? So he does recognize that. He seems to take some degree of responsibility for that. And he graciously allows Laban to save face. Okay, he could have said, no way. As I said, he could have said, you give me the one that we made a deal. So instead, he, despite the deceit, lets him save faith, right? Yet, we do see some important seeds of discontent sowed right here at the end of this section, right? So what's the key thing here? We leave knowing that he loved Rachel more than Leah. This is not starting out well. Okay? So it's not going to go well. So the whole imbroglio is dripping with parallels, like mother, like brother. Somebody said that earlier. Okay? Same DNA in the family. Favoritism catalyzes deceit. Right? So favoritism is never a good thing in the process. The younger upstages the older. Right? Jacob in the preeminence and Rachel in being given first in marriage. Poor visibility seems to have played a role in both circumstances, and father and son have similar responses when the deception is revealed. So, you know, it's kind of interesting. I think of, you know, the book of Ecclesiastes, and what's the point of Ecclesiastes? There's nothing new under the sun, right? Vanity, vanity, it's all vanity. Well, nothing new under the sun here. We're kind of going through the same old process, and we keep going through the same old stuff over and over again. So, deception and aftermath, and we ain't even going to get nearly as far as I thought today. Someone read 31 to 35. We'll get started on the aftermath here.
Now the Lord saw that Leah was unloved, and he opened her womb. But Rachel was barren. Leah conceived and bore a son, and named him Reuben. For she said, because the Lord has seen my affliction, surely now my husband will love me. Then she conceived again and bore a son. She said, because the Lord has heard that I am unloved, he has therefore given me this son also. So she named him Simon. She conceived again and bore a son and said, this time my husband will become attached to me, because I have borne him 3 sons. Therefore, he was named Levi. She conceived again and bore a son and said, this time I'll praise the Lord. Therefore, she named him Judah. Then she stopped bearing.
Okay, so we're going to go through this section and we'll stop with this today. I just kind of want to walk you through. And I want you to appreciate the names in each of these situations, okay? You've probably looked at this before, but it's kind of fun to do in the process. Now, this is an interesting section, this 29, 31 to 24. I won't belabor the question for you. What's going on here is we're getting a parenthetical break in this account of Jacob. And what we're going to learn in here is, or is going to be recorded, is the birth of the royal family and what is really going to become the 12 tribes of Israel. Okay, so we kind of get this break. This is important. This is the centerpiece, really, of the whole Jacob narrative. Now, what is the organizing principle of the parenthetical? Kind of how is it organized in terms of the birth?
Age, firstborn.
Yeah, that's the trap question, okay? So it's not a chronological recording. Okay, it's recorded in mother order. Okay, so we really need to read the whole section to help you get this. The birth narrative goes by the mothers, okay, and it tells a story and a tale about the whole birth scenario. Okay, so pictures are all the easier, so I'll just do that. So here's them. So group one is Leah. She has these first 4 boys, right? So we have Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Okay, 4 boys. Group two is now Bilhah. Now, who's Bilhah? Who's handmaiden?
Rachel.
Okay, so Rachel's a little fussy now. She wants to get back in the act. She says, well, I'll give you my handmaiden. And she bears 2 sons, Dan and Naphtali, right? Well, Leah says, anything you can do, I can do better, right? So here's Zilpah, right? And what does she do? She bears 2 more sons, Gad and Asher, right? Well, I guess old Leah's not done yet. Right, so she comes back after this little sordid mandrake exchange, right? She hires him out for the night, or a couple nights it appears, and basically she gets 3 more sons, Issachar and Zebulun, and then this daughter, Dinah. So this is the only daughter reported in this section, obviously, because we're going to hear about her later. And then finally, what? Right at the end of this whole thing, a couple little verses thrown in. Oh, and God remembered Rachel. Right, and Rachel's womb is open. She bears a son, Joseph. And then some years later, we're going to get the son, Benjamin, the caboose. Okay? So that's kind of the whole process and the picture. So it's going in that order. Now, there's a couple of other times. When they actually do the genealogy later, you'll see a different order. When you see the blessing at the end in chapter 49, there's a different order. So basically, this birth narrative is recorded the way it is to explain what's going on. Okay, it wants to tell a story. And the story is this ignoble tale of this sibling rivalry, right? So we see this horrible sibling rivalry and this competition. So what is at the center of this struggle between the two gals? What's at the center of the struggle?
Jacob loved Rachel more.
Jacob loved Rachel more, right? So
God's
right.
God's blessing more on
yeah. Each one coveted what the other one had. Right? Each one coveted what the other one had. What? Rachel had love. Leah wanted love. Leah had what? Children. Rachel wanted kids. Right? So each of them are in this kind of little death struggle for preeminence. right? Each of them wanting what the other was, right? Which is, I think, a very important implication reminder, and that is that discontent is a significant source of sin. So you think about your lives, and you think about our lives, and you think about when sin becomes kind of active in your life, when it kind of begins to breed, as James talks about in chapter 1, you can probably trace it back to some desire, which is some level of discontent, right? Now, there are good desires. I want to know the Lord more. I want to grow more closely. And there's pretty simple answers for that. Pray, read your Bible, you know, get in a good church, all those different kind of things. But their most desires are founded in something that we want that we don't have, right? True? Everybody that way, right? You know, it never seems to be enough. Whatever we have, it's like more. You know, it's funny. It's how the Lord used, you know, my prior life to draw me to saving faith, which was go through this process of work and had some success, and then I'm sitting there saying, well, what do I do now? Go chase more of that stuff? And so, you know, oddly, discontent can come from different circumstances. It can come from little. It can come from abundance. I mean, you know, everybody thinks, well, if I just had more money, I'd be fine, right? Look at all these rich people. They're miserable, many of them, truly. Their lives are a mess. They're taking drugs. They're trying to come up with experiences and highs, right? And it isn't the answer, right? So whatever end of the spectrums or anywhere we are in between, this idea of discontent, I think, is really a source. So when you're really thinking about your own life and you're in a fussy kind of mood, it's a great time to just sit and pray and reflect and ask the Lord to reveal, you know, what is the discontent? And then contentment, I don't know how you all feel. It's a wonderful feeling.
I like that.
You know, that's a good feeling. You like contentment.
I like that.
We go through it. Yeah, going through my experience with my dad, this situation with your nephew, I guess, right, Bobby, and so forth. You know, we want the answer. We want it to be over. But God wants us to be in the moment, right? He wants us to just say, look, I'll tell you when it's over. I'll tell you when it's done. I'll tell you what I'm teaching you in this process. Be content where I have you. What does Paul say, right? I have learned to be what? Content in what? Whatever circumstances I am in. Man, that's a good deal. I'd certainly want to pray for that. Okay, we're over our time, so we will get to her names of her children. We'll look at that next week. Lee, since you're leaving us, would you close us up here with a word of prayer here?
Father, again, we thank you for this time of study and just refreshment of the word. There's so many details to just comprehend, and it's good to hear that you use and sift through this information that you have given us for our growth and our education. Father, we always look for application.